Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. Professor Spruha Joshi, Ph.D., M.P.H., is a social epidemiologist whose research focuses on the ongoing overdose crisis and rapidly shifting cannabis legalization landscape, with a particular focus on reducing health disparities as they relate to drug policy. Dr. Joshi has an undergraduate degree in psychology from Stony Brook University, an M.P.H. in epidemiology from Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, and a Ph.D. in epidemiology from the University of Minnesota. Dr. Joshi completed a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center of Opioid Epidemiology and Policy at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine. Dr. Joshi is also one of the co-authors of a research article published September 27th in the journal JAMA Psychiatry entitled "One Year Association of Drug Possession Law Change with Fatal Drug Overdose in Oregon and Washington." Dr. Joshi, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start from the top. Your new article. The title does say it rather clearly, but still, if you could expand on it and tell us, what were you looking into?
Sure. Yeah. We were interested in evaluating a sort of two sort of legal changes in drug possession laws in Oregon and Washington. So first in Oregon, we were interested in studying the impact of what we'll call Measure 110. And so Measure 110 went into effect on February 1st of 2021. And we were interested to see what happened with overdoses given the sort of policy implementation. Similarly, in Washington, there was the Blake decision that happened with a Supreme Court decision, the state versus Blake, which went into effect later that same month on February 25th, 2021. And similarly went to look at overdoses in that to see what happened with overdoses in those states. And the reason why we wanted to look at overdoses in as sort of an outcome of this is that the overdose crisis is continuing. Reducing overdoses is a clear public health goal. And removing sort of criminal penalties for drug possession have the potential to reduce overdoses due to potential reduction in sort of the fear of engagement with law enforcement, so potentially increases for calls for help. And then also Measure 110 had a second aspect where it was increasing funds to treatment access from the cannabis tax revenue. And so what we did was we implemented what is known as a synthetic control method to be able to assess sort of what would have happened in each of these states had these legal changes not occurred.
What'd you find?
Yeah. And so what we found was that in both of those states, we found that while we did see an increase in overdose, which parallels what's happening across the country, these increases in overdose were not associated with these policy changes in either of the states.
One of the things I want to ask about is in terms of the national picture, the timeline, overdose, the overdose, well, the crisis of deaths from toxins in the drug supply, as well as overdose, that came rather late to the Pacific Northwest, yeah?
It did, yes, yeah. And so the trends of where fentanyl really started out east first and then arrived in the West Coast much later. And so we do see the sort of increase in fentanyl-associated deaths in the West later. Nationally, looking at sort of the impacts of the overdose crisis, at least during our study period, we saw that Oregon and Washington both sort of paralleled the same trends as the nation overall.
Were you finding surprising at all? I mean, did you expect to see any change, positive or negative, impact from decriminalizing simple possession of those small amounts?
Yeah, I don't know if surprising is the right word. I think initial aspect was that we would have seen something, I think was the general idea. But I think that it was really important for us to publish this article, given this is what our findings were, rather than even if the findings were no change. I think that you know, is an important thing. Also to note that this was really only a 1 year follow-up. And so I think that is another important thing to think about here is that things take time to change, you know, norms take time to change, policies take time to become sort of implemented in terms of like the funds being distributed. And so really this is a first snapshot, but
that actually brings me to that brings me to a question. Now, the funds, there was a great deal of hassle getting the money actually out of the state and into the these organizations, these agencies around the state. Did your the time frame you were looking at had those monies been dispersed yet, or were we still waiting on OHA to? I'm going to stop myself right there. Oh, we're still waiting on OHA.
No. Yeah, so exactly. Our study period ended in March of 2022, and the funds didn't start rolling out until April and September of that year. And so this one-year follow-up doesn't include any sort of those funds. And, you know, also one thing to say is that it's once the funds are distributed, it's not like automatically access to treatment increases, right? And so there's also this further delay of once the funds are distributed, it takes time for treatment. We're not just building buildings overnight.
Now, in terms of immediate effect, of course, the Measure 110, its decriminalization of simple possession, that went into effect quickly. Now, you've done some work looking at the impact of the impact on actual arrests, right?
Yes. Yeah. And so we were also interested in sort of a more proximal outcome, so that direct outcome of what's happening among arrests. And so what we found in both Oregon and Washington is that following these changes in laws, we do see a reduction in drug possession arrests across sort of all racial and ethnic groups, and immediately sort of following this policy change.
Well, these are the ones that make it all the way through the process to being an official, in quotes, arrest, right? As opposed to being picked up, hassled, having their stuff seized, and then being kicked loose before the paperwork clears.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think this is a really important point that like arrests really only capture a small percentage of sort of engagement with the criminal legal system and the small percentage of engagement with law enforcement for people who use drugs.
So now let's get back to your new paper. What were your conclusions?
Yeah. So our main finding and our main conclusion is that there's sort of no evidence of this association between the legal changes that removed or, you know, changed sort of the penalties for drug possession in Oregon and Washington and fatal drug overdose death rates.
Pretty straightforward. What are the policy implications for this?
Yeah, I think the main policy implication is that in sort of conjunction with the other paper where we look at arrests, a policy that reduces arrests for people who use drugs and didn't increase overdoses seems as a win to me.
So what question have I not yet asked you that I should have?
Yeah, I think one thing of important note is that we arrests and fatal overdoses are a really important outcome to examine, but there are other important sort of metrics that we could use. And I think really now increased focus should be continued monitoring of the fatal overdoses and seeing what's happening. But one thing to note is that our study was only able to assess sort of the overall overdose death rates, but really considering who is being most impacted by the overdose crisis now, especially particular racial and ethnic groups, future work should really look to see what is happening among those groups for their fatal overdoses. Also, what is happening with increased access to treatment in Oregon following now that the funds have been dispersed for a little bit? And I think those are next steps. And another big piece is also looking at non-fatal overdose.
I was going to ask you if you were going to be following up now that the funds have actually been dispersed to agencies and they're having a chance to get that money to work, creating programs and providing services to people.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely have plans to follow up on our study to continue to see. I think the big issue here, and I think that this is maybe something not so widely known or whatnot, is that while these initial reports come out that describe sorts of overdose death rates are going up by X percent or whatnot, the sort of final death data that becomes available from the CDC has a lag of 1 year. And so it takes time for that data to become available for us to analyze it. And so given that, that's why we were actually only able to really do a 1 year follow-up at the time that we had conducted the analyses. And so definitely have plans to continue as the data become more available.
Out of curiosity, do you have any idea how many of the attributions of death due to toxic drug supply and overdose, do you have any idea how many of those were based on an actual autopsy, an actual medical examiner report, or how many of them were simply the likely cause, for, according to the EMT or the police or whoever discovered
the cancer? That is a great question, and I think that is something that I don't have the answer to. But you know, I'm happy to point to somebody that might have that answer.
And I spoke to a researcher down in California. Gosh, I think it was a year or so ago, looking into over. Actually, found that there were a surprising number of overdose deaths that weren't being recorded, just because the autopsy hadn't been conducted, and for whatever reason, possibly because the person was nice and middle class looking and regular looking and in a nice little home, so that they wouldn't even suspect that they could have been using some kind of illegal drug. So I'm going to be continuing to follow this, and I'm looking forward to your follow up evaluations. Now, how can people out there follow, find out more about the work you're doing? Is there a website you can share? Are you on social media, that kind of thing?
Yeah, sure. I think the most easiest way is to my university faculty website. So I'm at the University of Michigan in the School of Public Health in the Department of Epidemiology. I think other sources to really follow along are, generally the Drug Policy Alliance always has a stellar work there, and they do a lot of work of synthesizing the research that's coming out from there. And so joining those sorts of listservs. And I am, I'm reachable by email if there are, sorts of further questions about this research or subsequent research that comes up.
Dr. Joshi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Professor Spruha Joshi, PhD, MPH. She's one of the co-authors of a research article published September 27th in the journal JAMA Psychiatry entitled 1 Year Association of Drug Possession Law Change with Fatal Drug Overdose in Oregon and Washington. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Haven Wheelock, MPH, is the Harm Reduction Services Manager at Portland area nonprofit Outside In. She's also one of the other co-authors of a research article published September 27th in the journal JAMA Psychiatry, again entitled 1 Year Association of Drug Possession Law Change with Fatal Drug Overdose in Oregon and Washington. Now, folks, I've been talking to in Washington State, doing research there. People up in BC, up in Canada, the other side of that border, have been saying that one of the things about fentanyl is that people seeking it out are able to use less at a time and are smoking the stuff rather than injecting. Are you seeing that here?
Yeah, very much so. So over the last probably year and a half, 2 years, we've seen a really big transition from folks who were injecting heroin are now smoking fentanyl. And for now, I would say the primary way people are using fentanyl is smoking it. I am cautious that people will make that transition to injecting. Some people, not all people, but some people will start injecting fentanyl. And I don't think we're really prepared for what that will look like when that happens. But it is something like we are starting to hear more people talking about injecting fentanyl. But, I've been doing this work for over 20 years, and I've never seen the drug supply change so fast. I've never seen how people engage with substances. Like, I've been trying to talk to people about switching from injecting to smoking for decades, right? And I've always failed. I never really was all that great at it. But with fentanyl coming into the drug supply, people really did switch to smoking. And fascinatingly, we're actually seeing, and this is anecdotal, but we're seeing folks who historically have been injecting methamphetamines also switching to smoking methamphetamines. And so we're seeing that transition happening away from injecting even other substances, which I just is, from a public health standpoint, from an infectious disease standpoint, is a great move, right? You're not going to get HIV smoking substances. You're not going to get endocarditis, osteomyelitis, so many of the risks that are associated with injection drug use kind of just go away when the needle parts go away for an individual, not for the society. But it has been really interesting. But I am holding a lot of caution because I do think over the next couple of years, we will see folks transition back to injecting fentanyl, just based on like the research we have on how people initiate injecting other drugs, right? Like most people don't start using syringes. They start smoking, they start snorting, and then that transition happens as tolerance happens, as prices for substances change. Things like that play a factor as well, but it really is right now people smoking.
One of the things that I recall from, weed is my thing. One thing about that, you know, smoking is obvious. It smells. You can see people doing this thing with a glowing stick in their hand, obviously. I mean, it's obvious. Whereas with an edible, well, just nibble, nibble, dibble. No one can tell. No one can smell it. So it's some people would move to that kind of thing, especially if they're going to be in a public situation. Now, to what extent do you think that the sort of public, the manufactured public rage about people smoking in public might, how much impact do you think that's going to have in pushing people toward the more easily concealed injection use?
Yeah, I mean, it is a factor, like, and it is something I think about. I think right now, and this could change, especially if like we increase penalties and recriminalize public use, things like that. I do think some of the concealment stuff could come into play in terms of people transitioning. I think right now, the benefits of not having to stick a needle in your skin and the lower risk for overdose is a factor that people are like sitting with. And we're not really seeing like, I need to be sneaky, so I'm going to inject as something people are talking about to me at this point. But some of that is that there is, I think if criminal penalties change, which they could, then we may see more of that.
Further north here in Abiyala, up in the part called Canada in Vancouver, they, in addition to the de facto and now de jure decrim, they have safe consumption sites. Insight, of course, is most famous, but there are others that are available.
Nearly 20 of them at this point.
What impact would those have in terms of the city of Portland?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge advocate for overdose prevention sites. I really do. I think overdose prevention sites play an important role in communities, especially communities like Portland, that on top of having an addiction crisis, which we see very blatantly, we also have a housing crisis happening where the cost of housing is so high that people are forced to live outside. And so, you know, a lot of the public pushback around decrim right now is around public use of substances. And truth be told, I don't want to be on the max train with somebody smoking methamphetamine either, right? Like, I don't want you smoking on the train I'm on. And I smoke cigarettes. Like, if I can't smoke cigarettes, please don't like smoke other things. But, you know, and so there is a lot of public outcry and a lot of like pressure to respond to the public drug use. And giving people a safe place to be is helpful, right? And I would love to see overdose prevention spaces open in our communities. I think not only do we know based on like international and now even more recently, like local, as in New York and San Francisco, both have published papers around their overdose prevention sites that operated. We know that they save lives. We know that they like reduce public nuisance crimes and calls to police. Like they are a helpful intervention that I believe our country needs to be, like, it's not just a Portland thing. It's an all of a, like, nationally, these spaces are really important, but especially in places where homelessness, right, is such a factor in the lives of everyone, they can be a really helpful intervention and tool.
That was part of my conversation with Haven Wheelock, Harm Reduction Services Manager at Portland area nonprofit Outside In. She's one of the co-authors of a research article published September 27th in the journal JAMA Psychiatry entitled 1 Year Association of Drug Possession Law Change with Fatal Drug Overdose in Oregon and Washington. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. We still have a few minutes, so let's turn from the Pacific Northwest to Colorado, where the state government is looking into overdose prevention centers, also known as safer consumption sites. The Colorado State Legislature's Joint Interim Opioid and Other Substance Use Disorders Study Committee held a hearing on September 27th to discuss draft legislation for the next session. One of the bills they discussed would authorize local communities to establish overdose prevention centers. Let's hear a little of the public testimony. First, we'll hear Jennifer Dillon. She's followed by Richard Woodruff.
My name is Jennifer Dillon. I'm a policy advocate with the Colorado Drug Policy Coalition, an organization that advocates for evidence-based drug policy guided by public health best practices and rooted in the principles of harm reduction. I want to quickly note that about 3 hours ago in the UK, they authorized their first overdose prevention center pilot project in Glasgow, Scotland, bringing the number of countries that have adopted these facilities to 17. Their use continues to expand because they work. Every 5 minutes, someone in our country dies from a drug overdose. Nearly 1 in 10 adults have a family member who has died from a drug overdose, not just someone they know, but a family member. And for every fatal overdose, there are 14 non-fatal overdoses that present to an emergency department. That's over 4,000 people each day assisted successfully by healthcare workers in our hospitals, workers who are stretched too thin and burning out in record numbers. Beyond that are the overdoses that are successfully reversed in the community each day, most often by people who use drugs, but also by family and friends of the person overdosing, by passersby, by librarians, baristas, and fast food workers. There was a recent excellent article in the Denver Post that detailed stories of ordinary Coloradans thrust into scary, traumatizing situations that they never signed up for. We can throw them in a lifeline in the form of overdose prevention centers. I deeply appreciate this committee's work over these past several months and your continuing study to determine the right response to our current drug health crisis. Existing harm reduction initiatives, such as expanded access to overdose reversal drugs and syringe services, play an important role in reducing disease transmission and death, but they are insufficient to what we now face. The type of harm reduction centers proposed in this bill would provide a vital resource to our communities, one that would reduce the numbers of both fatal and non-fatal drug overdoses, reduce public drug use, reduce the spread of infectious disease, keep people who use drugs and other community members safer, reduce stress on our hospitals and emergency departments, save taxpayers money, and facilitate people entering treatment and recovery at much higher rates. At an overdose prevention center, participants are accepted as all of who they are, including their drug use. This allows staff and participants the opportunity to build relationships based on the kind of honesty that many practitioners see as the key to creating a true therapeutic alliance, the kind of alliance that people who use drugs almost never encounter otherwise because of the stigma that they face. This experience of radical acceptance is what gives safe use sites their transformational potential. It is internally inconsistent that we tell people, don't use alone, and then don't offer a safe place to do that. People aren't using drugs in public because they're antisocial and unaware of social norms. They use drugs in public places because they don't have a safe indoor place or a safe person. They want to make sure if they overdose, someone will see them and be able to help. In the context of a street drug supply that is increasingly unpredictable and dangerous to navigate, using drugs in public is a wise, self-protective, self-stabilizing, even responsible step. A responsible step on our part in return is to offer a safe indoor place and safe people on staff to help. If you want to reduce homelessness, garbage, and human waste in communities, give people public washrooms, trash service, and housing. In the same way, if you want to reduce public drug use and drug paraphernalia litter, give people overdose prevention centers. The impact of overdose rates on our first responders and healthcare systems, particularly when recruitment and retention is already so low, threatens our ability to respond to other health emergencies. It's making us all less safe. It's also incredibly expensive. Overdose prevention centers save communities money. A single center can offer a savings of millions of dollars in healthcare resources each year and represent an effective and responsible stewardship of our tax dollars. People who will use drugs regardless of how harshly they're criminalized for it. The alternative to safe use sites isn't people not using. The alternative to safe use sites is unsafe use sites, and they exist all around us. If you oppose safe use, then you're perpetuating unsafe use, and trauma and death is the result.
My name is Richard Woodruff. I am a resident of Denver. I come before the committee today representing only myself, and I thank you for this opportunity. I come forward in strong support of overdose prevention centers. We are in the midst of a terrible opioid overdose epidemic. Those effects are compounded by a very unpredictable drug supply. This issue has warranted a front page article in the Denver Post just this past week. Our grief as a nation is and should be overwhelming. While we must address the larger societal and mental health components which contribute to this challenge, those efforts will take a lot of time and a lot of money. In the short term, for very little money, allowing OPCs to operate is a small step forward to save our fellow Coloradans.
That was Richard Woodruff. He was preceded by Jennifer Dillon. They were testifying before the Colorado Legislature's Joint Interim Opioid and Other Substance Use Disorders Study Committee on September 27th in regard to draft legislation that would allow municipalities in Colorado to authorize the establishment of overdose prevention centers, which are sometimes referred to as safer consumption sites. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Please give its page a like. Share it with friends. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!